This is going to be a little bit of a long story, so I'm going to divide it into two parts. We'll start it today, and we'll finish it next month, which I think will be appropriate. Now, we started off with the words of P.T. Barnum, as I said, probably the most famous universalist that we know of, at any rate. So we're going to look at first, where were the universalists in the time from the 1700s and 1800s all the way through to the mid-20th century? And where were the Unitarians in this process? Now, I'm going to tell you right away, this is going to be a little bit of one of those yay, boo stories. It's going to move back and forth. It was not a linear path. It was not a straight line. In 1889, the Universalist denomination ordained Joseph Jordan, the first African-American ever welcomed into its ministry. He was drawn to the faith by reading Thomas Whitmore's The Plain Guide to Universalism. It is not known which passages most influenced him. Nevertheless, one in particular must have spoken to him. Quote, "As he is creator, so he is the parent of all. See then that there is a common bond, a tie uniting the vast family of man. No national boundary can dissolve this tie. No distance, no circumstances of birth or color, or no misfortune, no oppression, neither poverty nor vice, nor disgrace, nor death can sunder it. When men can cease to be offspring of God, then they will cease to be brethren, who, believing and realizing this, can be unkind, who can be oppressor of his brethren." Now, I've done this before, but I'm just going to refresh you. There is it's a kind of joking way of talking about it, but it's really does express the distinction between universalism and Unitarianism. We like to say that universalists believed that God was so good that salvation was possible for everyone. Unitarians, on the other hand, believed that mankind was so good that God could not refuse it. So as you hear some of these things, just hold that little basic distinction in mind. Now, this understanding of universalism was shared by Quillen Shinn, the universalist missionary who supported Jordan in bringing universalism to the black community of Norfolk, Virginia. Shinn said, "No man can be a universalist whose love does not take in all races and colors of men." Now, one of the things that you're hearing in this is that the universalists had missionaries to the Negro. This was kind of the way this was done at the time. It wasn't exactly a matter of inviting people into the institution, their institutions per se, in a way, but really it was more of a missionary thing to go to and engage the colored people. Yet, in 1897, William McLaughlin, while serving as the Universalism's Southern missionary, advised the annual meeting that no effort be undertaken to admit African Americans to local Sunday schools or young people's Christian unions. That was something that long predated LRY, which we've talked a little bit about. This recommendation was based on his belief that for whites, such an effort would be the same as a lighted match in a powder magazine. So just for anyone who doesn't know what a powder magazine is, it's where you store all the gunpowder. So he's saying that this would... Gail?
Was that a double negative? I mean, he said, don't let them into sense.
Yes, because he thought that in order to do that, if we did that, it would be like, it would just set things off. It would cause a huge conflagration. The Reverend Dr. John Murray Atwood, Dean of St. Lawrence Theological School. Now, the Unitarians and Universalists between them used to have several schools across the country. The theological schools quite often were the core school that birthed a university. The university, for example, for Unitarianism, if for those of you that don't know, is Harvard. That is the school that Unitarianism birthed. So, and the theological schools across the country were the Harvard Divinity School, the St. Lawrence Theological School, the Meadville School, which is in Chicago, or was in Chicago. I think it's decentralized now. And then eventually, later on, we have Star King School out here on the coast. Reverend Dr. John Murray Atwood, Dean of the St. Lawrence Theological School, in the great task of a small church, he said that Universalism's aim was to win people to the way of life that will save all. See, you can hear the universalism in that, right? Based on a belief in the supreme worth of every personality, which was a given from a good creator. Proclaiming that universalists believe in the inherent worth of every person and are concerned with and open to everyone, colored and colorless, was easier than making it so. Now, by contrast, so you get this movement that's going on at this point. This is just post the Civil War. So people are trying to gather their minds and get, well, where are we with this thing, and does it matter to us? And they're trying to make it matter, but you have to understand that both Universalism and Unitarianism at that time were completely Eurocentric. Okay? So they're actually doing this from a standpoint of what are our spoken principles, and they're trying to move from that particular place. For more than 3 years, there was a debate in a magazine called The Leader. In 1942, Van Schaick, we missed that part. Here's what you need to hear. Universalism's muted message on race relations is in part due to John Van Schaick, the editor of the Christian Leader. Van Schaick believed in the superiority of the white race. This is a universalist. Under his influence, universalism's theology proclaimed that the oneness of the human family was muddled and twisted in its this particular national journal. In 1903, prior to becoming the journal's editor, Van Schaick was one member of a three-member commission who wanted to close the mission school. Now, the mission school was in Suffolk, Virginia, and it was supported by the Universalist Church. I think I've mentioned this to you before. My background is that I come from the AME Church. I come from the African Methodist Episcopal Church. That's where I grew up. I found out only last year that Richard Allen, the founder of that church, was supported in doing so by Universalists. So the mission portion of the Universalist process was really quite real. It was very real. One of the things was this school that was started in Suffolk, Virginia, for people of color. And this was kind of necessary in the late 1800s because after the slaves were freed, there was no way for them initially and intrinsically to just sort of integrate into the society. They had to somehow get the tools necessary to begin to relate to that society. So the starting of these missionary schools was an important thing. And they were done in the community. And they weren't done in the same way, say, for example, that the Canadians dealt with the Native Americans there, in which what they were trying to do was really is turn the Native Americans, they were trying to get them to forget their language, forget their religious backgrounds, everything, and to really become white Canadians. But here, this is a little bit different. This is left to to the clergy, really, which has over centuries been responsible for maintaining the knowledge from one era of time to another, was to designed to take African-American clergy trained, perhaps, in universalist theologies or seminaries, and then put them, let them go into their communities and support them in those communities. Now, Van Schaick believed in the superiority of the white race. Under his influence, universalism's theology proclaimed the oneness of the human family. Proclaiming the oneness of the human family was muddled and twisted. In 11, he was the lone member of the Universalist leadership that was opposed to the expansion of this missionary school in Suffolk. Before his editorship, feature articles about the Suffolk mission had been common, but during his term, which lasted from 23 to 45, such articles became largely the purview of the General Sunday School Association, the GSSA, its annual appeal, which appeared in The Leader, which was this magazine, from 1918 on. It was the key component in the American Friendship offering, which included updates about the Suffolk mission, stories, poetry, activities, lists of things that the school needed. And The Leader's editorial pages, however, began to reflect Van Schaick's bias. Van Schaick's bigotry was so self-evident that in August of 39, Llewellyn Jones, the editor of the Christian Register, the official journal of the AUA, that's the Unitarian side, okay, felt called to respond. The Register published an editorial title, Is Color Appearance or Reality? Now, there's so much, this is a very dense story, so I'm skipping over parts of the story. For more than 3 years, this debate goes on and on and on. In 42, Van Schaick explained his position in the editorial address to Dean Atwood, Mr. Perry et al. There are two ways of dealing with race discrimination. One is by forcing the issue, taking colored students into white schools, training colored people to be ministers for denominations without colored churches, making some of these students despise their own race and refuse to have anything to do with it, promoting all the social contacts which lead to marriage and working for a day, when the colored people will be absorbed in the white race or the white race in the yellow race. We admit freely that the process of absorption is going on now and not usually with motives as high-minded as those of the young couple under discussion, which I haven't gone into. You can see that we've got like a really divided perspective, some seriously divided perspectives at that time. But this is the church's history. Now, who was this Mr. Perry that was mentioned in the address? A letter from Oscar Hoyt Perry had appeared in The Leader under the headline "A Universalist and the Negro." Perry wrote, "As applied to our brothers of Negro blood, this ostracism is political, economic, and social, and most deplorable. We Universalists might well take a leading part in this reform. In fact, as exponents of brotherhood, we must take this stand or else be guilty of rank duplicity and hypocrisy. In that case, our church will rot and die, and it will well deserve its fate." To some extent, as Mark points out here, his words were prophetic. Now, that's about 42. What happens next is critical to understanding how things kind of began to turn around, which is World War II happened. And the, let's call it propaganda of the governments in the West, and particularly our own here in the U.S., was that we were fighting against the Nazis for freedom and democracy. This became basically the whole conversation that went on that eventually allowed the U.S. to get involved in World War II. A lot of people participated in that war. Among them were people of color. And what happened with this is that the United States gets itself kind of cornered, paints itself into this corner where it has to then support democracy, freedom, equality, etc. Because the alternative was the genocide that had been perpetrated against the Jews at that time. So when this happens, the nation really became divided on the one hand, but had taken a stand on the other hand. Because even after the Civil War, the truth of the matter was is that the United States didn't really have to go with the idea the slaves were free, do whatever you do, you're on your own. And they really didn't have to support this movement, except along comes World War II. And the fact of the matter is in order to get people to take a side in that war, they had to come up with a point of view. They had to come up with what was ostensibly, truly, kind of propaganda. Also at that time, we had the Dust Bowl that Marianne was talking about, and we had a tremendously difficult time. There was the first of the Great Depressions that had occurred, and so there were a lot of disenfranchised people. The WPA was one of the things that helped with that, and so forth, which was a step towards socialism on our part. But we were still not comfortable with socialism. So this is a kind of a little mixture, a mixture that was occurring, and the beginning of actually an internal war that was reflective, in a sense, of the Civil War, but the alignments were all sliced up and different, and we were just beginning to get into this. Now, just after Kennedy, and we're going to take it through here, and we're going to kind of slow down on this. Just after Kennedy, the civil rights movement, which had begun in the 50s, was beginning to take root. Did we pass by that slide that said that if it weren't for Rosa Parks, we probably never would have heard of Dr. Martin Luther King?
Yes.
Okay. So that was the beginning, you might say, of the modern movement of the civil rights movement, that particular bus sit-in, we'll call it. So the movement had begun and had started in the South, and at a point it became very heated in Alabama. And when that happened, Dr. King sent out a letter. It was actually a telegram. I think this was their version of a text that went out, or a, what do you call it? It's a, what do you call the list?
Tweet.
Or a tweet, no, but I mean, like, you guys have a mailing list, you know? It's like the mailing list. The what?
Email.
Yeah, and the SJC has, like, this mailing list, and they can, like, notify a lot of people, like, really quick of some particular action. And so he sent out a telegram went around the world. And what he did was he called for leaders, for religious leaders of every denomination, of every particular religious walk, and at any place in the planet to please show up at the focal point of this, which was Selma in Alabama. And I'll be doggone if that didn't happen. And who do you think one of the denominations was that got that letter?
Unitarianism.
Unitarianism and Universalism, because by that time they had just merged. I think like 3 or 4 years earlier, the Unitarian Universalist became the Unitarian Universalist at that point. And they had their first president at that point, who was Dana McLean Greeley, a Yankee from Maine, down east, as we say. And when this thing hit, it actually, there was a moment where the whole Unitarian Universalist world, still in this kind of not really totally settled one way or the other, kind of hit this little wobble and kerfuffle point for just a moment. And when it broke, it suddenly broke left. That's the way we would think of it today. That's not exactly how it was thought of then. But it suddenly broke left. And it was, there had been a march on Washington already. 1,600 Unitarian Universalists showed up at that march, which for a tiny denomination is, that's a lot of people. But when the thing in Selma broke out and Dr. King sent out that letter, you were there. Ah. The one that actually, there was one that happened before Selma. I'm going to give you the name of this book and I want you to read it. It's really good. Dolores was there. We're really shocked to hear that, aren't we? So I want to just kind of get through this point and to say that the whole thing, the turnaround that happened that actually got the motion from the UUA to become involved in this almost happened in a single day. There was the call came in, that telegram came in, and then when the Homer Jack and Orloff Miller and some of these people heard this, Orloff was the head of the campus ministry, and Homer Jack was the head of the social justice thing with the UUA in Boston. They flew into action around it, and the truth of the matter is that Dana, the president of the UUA, wasn't really sure that he was going to go to this. His brother, who was another Unitarian minister, called him and said, and asked him and said, "Look, Dana, if you will go to this thing, I'll go down there with you." Dana demurred and said he wouldn't go. And his brother he stopped and he went back home. And that was kind of the state that some of the leadership was in at that time. Many of the churches did not want their people to go. They didn't want the minister to go. They said, "Your job is here with us. What are you going to go down there and do? What's it with these people?" And a lot of the churches wouldn't allow their ministry to go, wouldn't allow their clerics to go. Some of them, on the other hand, some people, there were a few cases in which the ministers were slow to kind of move on it, and the members of the congregation just pooled money, put it together, and determined who could make the trip and go, and then, you know, two or three people would go. But we'll take a look at that a little bit next time. What I want to do right now is, I know you thought you had gotten away with not having to talk to another person in the room, but that's not going to happen, okay? I could have spent this time talking more about Dr. King. And what happened when I thought of that is I woke up one morning, and I'm clearest in the morning when I wake up, and I heard something say to me, "You know, Dr. King wouldn't be very interested in you spending the whole time focused on him and talking about him. He would want you to talk about what he would want to talk about." And then shortly thereafter, I heard something about a person who did an act of kindness, just an act of kindness. And then another, and the second one that I heard was actually interesting. It was our own Duhavemir. And Doug, I think you got, did you get that? You got that email, didn't you? Yeah. And Duhavemir was just going down the street by himself one day, and he saw an old Winnebago there, and he thought, "Oh, I ought to stop and see who's in this old Winnebago," because he'd lived in an RV before himself. And then he thought, "No, that's crazy. That's a crazy thought. And I better leave these people alone." But, you know, he can't. That's not Duhavemir. He can't do that. So he stops. He goes back. He knocks on the door of the RV, and people answer, and he welcomes them because he'd been in an RV down in Hayward someplace, and they will run you out of town if you have your RV parked somewhere. They just run you out of town, like what Marianne was really talking about, what goes on to this day. And he decided to just connect with them and welcome them to town, which he did. It made a huge difference in their lives. Do you happen to have that email with you? You want to try reading from there? You want to come up and read it? It's about this long. It's not a big deal. Don't worry about it. I'll just tell you this. It really turned a lot around for these people. He made this connection with them, and then they kind of went their separate ways for a while, and then quite a bit later, he bumps into them again, and they welcomed him in, and they told him what a big difference it made for them. So, here's what I want you to do. I want you to pick somebody, and this time, it doesn't matter if it's someone you've come here with or someone you don't know. Anybody you want to do this with, just look around. You will connect with someone. Do it with them. And I want you to pick something to do between now and next Sunday. And I want you to generate a random act of kindness, something that works for you, that fits for you, and make it a little stretch and do it for someone that you don't know. Betsy? Well, you can do that, and I like that idea. Uh-oh, that's a good idea. No, what I want you to do is I want you to commit to doing something with the person, with your other person, so that you have someone who's going to witness with you what it is you say you're going to do. That's different than having a good idea in your head. See, I have a lot of good ideas in my head. I don't know where they go after a while. You know, they probably go back to the good idea place. But if you commit with someone to do that, to do this particular thing, and then you tell them that you will report back to them a little, you know, within the week. And I don't care if they're going out of town. You can still report back to them. You've got stuff better than Telegram to get in touch with each other. Then the chances are you will probably do it. So is everyone clear on what this is? Do this for Dr. King. Not everyone is clear. Do you understand what an act of kindness is? Is there anybody in the room who doesn't understand what an act of kindness is? Raise your hand. It's okay. It can be a first for you. It's just fine. Okay. Do you understand the process of figuring out something that you want to do and you want to take it out there into the world and get it done? Do you understand the process of talking with someone and telling them or letting them help you work it out? And then with that person, commit to doing it. We together so far?
But that person doesn't have to be with you.
No, not at all. I trust your honesty. Wadi. But you do need to check back in with them to let them know between now and next Sunday that you got it done. Wadi, go ahead. Okay. Can you give it? What would be a stretch for you? Now that might be a step off a cliff for you. That might be a little more than a stretch. See, this is the kind of thing that stops us. Do you get that? This is what stops us. It's like, you know, what's too far? What's too little? What's too much? You know. There was a man named Stephen Gaskin, and he used to say, the 11th commandment is you do too know what I mean. Okay? So, any if you're still unclear on any part of this, let me know. We're good? Go.
All right, if everyone can start moving back to their seats, we're going to do some thanks and announcements.
As soon as we're done with this, we can have discussion, coffee discussion after the service. We can do that, but we got to get to after the service.